The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This podcast contains adult themes and graphic violence. Listener discretion is advised.
A commercial-free version of this podcast is available on Patreon for $1 per month. Patreon.com/Beyond Contempt Podcast. I'm Renee, and this is Beyond Contempt True Crime. As promised by the tagline of this podcast, I'll tell you stories that you've never heard before. And I'm pretty sure that this case has never been covered by another podcast. And you likely never heard about it unless you were living in Green Bay in the 1980s. You're listening to episode 36, Pamela Bullock. Pamela Sue Metzger was born on October 21, 1948, in Spencer, Wisconsin, to parents Myrtle and William Metzger Sr. Pam's brother Bill Jr. was 7 years older than her, and he often teased his sister and called her Baby Huey, which was a reference to a 1950s cartoon. Pam was a tomboy, and in elementary school spent time with their best friend, climbing trees, riding bikes, and riding horses bareback. In college at the end of her freshman year, the Navy sent her brother, Bill Jr., on a mission to Hanoi, Vietnam. Bill's plane crashed after it was hit, which resulted in him sustaining a broken leg and being captured. He spent 6 years as a prisoner of war. Pam's family started the first POW/MIA chapter in Wisconsin. They facilitated a national letter-writing campaign that persuaded the Vietnamese to take good care of their prisoners. They eventually released Bill Jr. in March 1973, and he appreciated all the work his family put into bringing him home. As she got older, Pam's sports were swimming and running. Pam's circle of friends described her as an outgoing and vivacious person who was always involved with her community. She was on the yearbook staff, was a cheerleader, and was the manager of the men's collegiate swim team. One of the members of the swim team was a man named Robert John Bullock. He was born on June 25, 1947, grew up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and was known for being a shy kid. Bob loved the outdoors and went camping, fishing, and swimming with his younger brother. In college, Bob played tennis and was a swimmer. He also had a passion for running. Bob was a tall, dark, and handsome type, which Pam fell in love with. He graduated from the University of Stevens Point in January 1970 with a bachelor's degree in biology and also a minor in physical education. Pam graduated from Point a semester later in June 1970 with a bachelor's degree in education. Pam and Bob were married on August 15, 1970 in Wisconsin Rapids. Pam's mother was her maid of honor, and Bob's brother Kenneth was the best man. After their reception, they honeymooned in the Bahamas and loved it so much that they later bought a timeshare there. The couple stayed in the Racine area for a while, but Bob was having difficulty finding a teaching job he wanted. The Bullocks moved to San Diego, California on a 3-year assignment when Bob enlisted in the Marines. He completed a master's degree while they lived in California, and they also had their first child, Christopher, in 1972. Bob and Pam moved back home to Wisconsin and settled in Green Bay. In 1974, they welcomed Carla Bullock into the world. Bob finally got into the Green Bay school system and landed a teaching job in 1979. Bob taught special education at Edison Junior High in Green Bay and was a major in the Marine Reserves. And Pam worked as a special education teacher in the Freedom School System which was fairly close to Green Bay. Running was a large part of their lives in Green Bay. Pam and Bob were serious about running and even ran half or full marathons. They were part of a community known as the Fun Run Group, which was a tight-knit group of friends that went on training runs, raced, and hung out together. On August 18, 1983, the Green Bay Police Department received a call from the Bullock residence. An intruder had broken into the house while Pam and Bob were home. That evening, they were out for their 13th wedding anniversary and grabbed a few drinks downtown. They arrived home pretty early that night and grilled food for dinner, then popped open a bottle of wine. After dinner, Bob and Pam were on the floor of the family room doing running stretches. Bob was showing Pam some of the newer stretches he learned at drill. Pam was facing the carpet, and the last thing she remembered was throwing up. Someone had hit Pam so hard in the back of the head that she suffered a life-threatening injury. Her skull fracture required an ICU stay. She received 10 stitches in the back of the head, and her skull fracture was so severe that her sense of smell was diminished. Pam couldn't remember anything else about the incident. She didn't even remember Bob getting up from the floor. He said that a kid in his late teens attacked him. The kid punched Bob in the stomach, and he passed out. When he woke up, he found Pam laying on the floor. In the ICU, Pam's neurologist said that she would not have permanent brain damage. Bob's was the only statement that was initially taken by police. A few minor items had been taken from the Bullocks' backyard a few months prior, but nothing significant was missing from their house after the attack. Earlier that summer, someone had been creeping around the neighborhood and was peeking in windows, but no one else in the neighborhood had their home broken into. A detective eventually visited with Pam in the hospital and suggested to her that Bob might have been the perpetrator. Pam didn't think Bob was capable of doing something like that. She needed a cane to walk and went out on disability for the semester to recover from this vicious traumatic brain injury. The detective wanted Bob and Pam to take polygraph tests, which they both eventually agreed to. Since Bob and Pam passed their polygraph tests, the detective considered the case unsolved. Pam's parents were divorced by that time. Her dad lived in Wisconsin Rapids and was remarried, and her mom moved down to Florida. Neither parent showed up to the ICU to visit Pam. Pam's friends couldn't figure out why Bob didn't call her parents. Maybe he was too embarrassed that he couldn't protect his wife. Or perhaps something else was going on. They weren't sure. One thing that bothered one of Pam's co-workers was Bob's statement to her about the family dog. The co-worker asked Bob if their dog had barked at the intruder, because every time she was in their house, that dog would incessantly bark at her. Bob said their dog never barked at anyone. Pam's co-worker found this comment to be both untrue and bothersome. Bob was really sweet to Pam immediately after the attack. But by September 1983, he reverted to bringing up some of their older marital problems. They had been seeing a marriage counselor for their issues prior to the attack. Pam felt Bob was acting much colder towards her, and the reasons became apparent when Pam found a receipt from Zales Jewelers in Bob's pants pocket. Pam's birthday was just around the corner in October, but with her being out on disability, money was tight. They couldn't really justify spending money on jewelry. Plus, Pam had previously worked at Rummel's Jewelers, and they were generous enough to always give her the family and friends discount. She couldn't figure out why Bob would go to a different jeweler to buy her a birthday present. Pam noticed Bob wrote their friend Linda's birthday on the calendar, except he spelled it completely wrong. Their friend was a L-Y-N-D-A, and on the calendar was scrawled L-I-N-D-A. Bob also screwed up the date. He had it written for the month of October, but their friend's birthday was on September 29th. When they sat with their marriage counselor in a session, Bob said that Pam was too dependent, and being married to her caused him to lose who he was as a person. The couple stopped attending events with the Fun Run group. They skipped training runs, Friday night fish fries, and the annual Halloween party. Pam's birthday was on October 21st, and she never received the jewelry. She found a coupon for a massage that was in an envelope addressed to Bob from a Linda, L-I-N-D-A, who was not their friend. Pam accused Bob of having an affair, and he did not deny it. Pam suspected it had been going on for a year. Linda Vanden Langenberg worked in the same school system as Bob and taught elementary school-aged kids. She was a Milwaukee native and earned her undergraduate degree from there as well. Linda was known for having a perfectionist personality, but was sensitive as well. She was into running, and many of the guys in the Fun Run group thought she was extremely attractive. When Pam and Bob sat down again with their marriage counselor, the options for Bob were laid out. He cannot continue on with what he was doing, and he was given three choices. Bob could leave Pam and live with Linda to decide if he needed to get a divorce. He could leave Linda, stay with Pam, and work on their marriage. Or Bob could leave both of them and see who he wanted to be with the most. Bob opted to stay with Pam and work on his marriage. He signed a contract that stated he would not talk to or see Linda for at least 6 months. Bob and Linda's affair was an open secret in the Fun Run group. Someone in the group even saw Linda run up to Bob's van at lunch and jump in with an ease that would be reserved for someone in an intimate relationship. Bob was supposed to be leading running clinics with Jim Drews from their running group. Jim noticed some weeks, instead of Bob leading a running group, he would take off and run with Linda. This was an awkward situation, as Jim's wife had a close friendship with Pam. Clearly, Bob was not honoring the contract he signed with Pam and their marriage counselor. Pam verified that Bob broke the contract when she went to their shared P.O. box and found Linda was sending him cards. Bob and Pam finally made it to their friend's Christmas party in December 1983. Pam was so tipsy and was not coherent that the couple left just as quickly as they arrived. The next morning, when Pam went running with one of her friends, they brought the party up, and Pam did not remember attending. Pam wasn't taking regular medication, but took the occasional sleeping pill. She was worried that maybe Bob had been slipping her sleeping pills so he could sneak around with Linda. Pam went to the doctor to ensure that her head injury wasn't playing a role in her memory loss. They gave her a clean bill of health, so she wasn't sure what was going on. Pam found a disconcerting poem in Bob's wallet. "I'm standing upon the seashore. A ship at my side spreads her sails to the morning breeze and starts for the blue ocean. She is an object of beauty and strength, and I stand and watch until at last she hangs like a speck of white cloud, just where the sea and sky come down to mingle with each other. Then someone at my side says, 'There she goes.' Gone where? Gone from my sight. That is all. She is just as large in mast and hull and spar as she was when she left my side, and just as able to bear her load of living freight to the place of destination. Her diminished size is in me, not in her. And just at the moment when someone at my side says, 'There she goes,' there are other eyes watching her coming and other voices ready to take up glad shouts, 'Here she comes.'" Pam was unsettled by the poem, and she wondered if she should feel afraid. This poem was perhaps something that would be read at a funeral. On Friday, January 13th, Pam found a powdery white substance in Bob's pocket. It appeared to be a crushed pill. Pam spoke to her personal therapist about it, and she was told to confront Bob, which she did. Bob claimed that he just stepped on his tablet bottle and crushed the pills on accident. Pam's therapist decided that stress caused her memory lapse at the December Christmas party. On Friday, April 6, 1984, Bob headed to Glenville, Illinois at 11:30 a.m. He was supposed to fly out of the Naval Air Base to Colorado for his Marine Reserve weekend in Denver. Bob was having car issues close to I-94 and Waukegan Road which caused him to miss his flight. He then decided he was going to take a commercial flight out of O'Hare in Chicago the next morning, but called it off. Bob thought it would be better to go home and see his wife, given their marital problems. He arrived back in Green Bay around 10:30 p.m. Instead of pulling up into the driveway, he parked down the street in the Preble High School parking lot. Bob wanted to surprise Pam and didn't want her to see his car. Instead of the Bullocks having a nice evening, they fought. Pam accused Bob of seeing Linda that day. According to Bob, their fight was short, and they went to bed within an hour of his return home. On April 7, 1984, at approximately 11:15 a.m., they dispatched a deputy to the Bullock residence. Bob Bullock called because there had been a grave accident. Bob told the officer that he spoke with his wife at 8:30 in the morning, when he filled up the tub with water so she could soak her legs. She was a runner and was supposed to be running a half marathon that day. Instead, she was lying motionless on the floor of the bathroom with a head full of wet hair. Pam must have been in the water for some time, as her skin was wrinkled and there was not a trace of a vital sign. More Green Bay Police Department staff had arrived, and they examined around the tub for any electrical devices that could have harmed Pamela Bullock. The victim was in good shape and did not take regular medication other than an occasional sleeping pill. The detective was also aware that there was an incident in this house several months ago where the victim was attacked, and they never found the perpetrator. The detective felt that all the factors in this situation were suspicious, given there wasn't an obvious cause for the victim's death. The Bullock's 11-year-old son and 9-year-old daughter were notably absent from the house. Some officers sat with Bob and tried to comfort him, as one detective went outside to look around. After searching around the yard, he entered the garage and took a look at the van inside. The firewall next to the engine was warm, meaning that the van had been used that day. The passenger seat was wet, which was not something they expected to find. The floor of the garage had a spot with grease and oil, but it appeared as if something was dragged through it, so photos were taken. When the detective walked back into the house, there were green sweats on top of a washer in the laundry room. The sweatshirt was dry, and the pants were wet. Along with the pants, they found a wet pair of underwear. The detective couldn't tell if the underwear was soiled with waste material or if it was just dirt. The washer was on spin cycle and contained one nightgown and two pairs of jeans. The coroner was on site and sampled the wet seat in the van. She sent the sample out for analysis to determine the composition of the wetness. In the bathroom, temperatures were taken of the bathwater, the broom, and of Pam's body, which was also checked for rigor. Pieces of dirt and debris in the tub were collected. The soles of a pair of red socking shoes were covered in mud and grease. They did not arrest Bob Bullock, but brought him down to the police station to answer questions. Bob waived his rights and was ready to talk. He explained how he missed his military flight for his reserve weekend for the Marine Corps in Denver, Colorado. Bob admitted to having an affair with Linda Vanden Langenberg. He said they briefly fought that night over Linda, since Pam felt Bob lied about missing his flight and spent the day with his mistress instead. Pam had a sleeping pill that night before they went to bed. During the night, Bob woke up and Pam was gone. He heard an engine running, and when he went to the garage, Pam was sitting in the passenger seat inside the running van. She was not responding to him, so he pulled her out of the vehicle and brought her back to the bedroom, where they went to sleep. In the morning, Bob got up, and Pam was still sleeping. He filled the tub up so she could soak her legs before her half marathon. Bob went back to the bedroom and tried to get her up. Pam wasn't really responding, so he told her that he was going to throw her in the bath. But even that did not elicit a response from Pam. He dragged her to the tub area and set her against a clothes hamper. Bob then checked on the kids, who said they had headaches. That is when he remembered the van had been running, and he opened some windows in the house. Bob made breakfast and folded clothes. He drove the van over to the high school to get his car that he left there the night before. Bob decided to not walk over because his car did not always start reliably. He drove his car home, then he walked back to pick up the van. After Bob returned home, he walked into the bathroom and found Pam face down in the tub. He pulled her out of the water and unsuccessfully performed CPR. He then called their marriage counselor to ask what he should do with the kids. Bob said he was told to get them out of the house, so he dropped them off at the mall, and he went back home to call 911. The detectives felt while Bob was working with them, there was an element of him that felt cold. When they originally arrived at his house after the 911 call, he never mentioned anything about Pam being in the van. After the interview with Bob was done, law enforcement started interviewing people in Pam and Bob's life. The primary detective in the case followed up with the Bullocks' joint marriage counselor. The only thing that was divulged was that the kids would be safe with Bob. Bob agreed to sign off on their joint counseling records so police could determine if Pam had a reason to commit suicide. Pam also had a personal therapist that the detectives would eventually interview. Law enforcement spoke with the Bullocks' neighbors, but they uncovered nothing major in those conversations. Detectives learned that the Bullocks had close relationships with all the people in their running group, and these people might help them understand the dynamics that were at play in the Bullocks' marriage. When one detective contacted Linda Vanden Langenberg, she agreed to an interview. That was quickly reversed after she spoke with a lawyer who advised her against it. They contacted Kevin Vanden Langenberg, who was now Linda's ex-husband. Right before Pam's assault in August 1983, Linda asked him for a divorce, which was completed by November 1983. Kevin felt that Bob and Linda's affair began in fall 1982 when they took a Red Cross CPR course together. Linda subsequently got into running and often ran with Bob alone. Law enforcement were able to find out more about the last few months of Pam and Bob's relationship. Pam was playing bridge with some of her girlfriends in January 1984, but was having a hard time socializing because Bob was seeing Linda again, even though he had agreed to work on their marriage. During the card game, she called their marriage therapist, and after a lengthy conversation, declared to everyone that she was going to kick Bob out of the house. By the end of that month, Pam served Bob divorce papers, but he refused to leave their home or do anything about the impending divorce. Finally, the court system ordered him to vacate the house, but he had joint custody over the kids. Bob became cold to Pam, and he even told her that he would be back in her life. Pam had a weakness for Bob, and their separation only lasted 2 weeks. Even though her friends tried to talk her out of it, Pam was dating Bob again, and he moved back into his house. Pam went to Bob's apartment to help him clean it out, and she found a Valentine's Day card addressed to Bob from Linda. She also found out that Linda bought a couples membership to the YMCA so Linda and Bob could work out in public together. At school, Linda sent Bob a piece of mail, which ended up in the wrong hands. The admin who received it read the note, and Linda was telling Bob that she was sorry, and she hoped that he didn't think she was a nymphomaniac. Linda was told she needed to dial it back and to use better judgment at school. Detectives then looked into any financial motives that Bob might have had. Pam had a personal $10,000 life insurance policy and also had another one from her employer. The Bullocks were in some financial trouble, but Pam was not aware of this because Bob handled the finances. She only realized their situation after she suspected the affair and began checking their banking records. Bob made $1,600 per month and received $200 to $300 per month for reserve pay. Pam made $1,250 per month and had been on disability for the latter half of 1983. Their mortgage was $1,300 per month, and they owed $6,000 on various debts and had to pay for a timeshare in the Bahamas. So their financial situation was very stretched. The detectives received a call from a teacher who saw that Bob had a book that was titled How to Survive the Loss of a Loved One, which was purchased a month before Pam died. Many people who were close to Pam often heard her stress about her marital issues and felt that she was depressed. They, however, did not feel she was suicidal, since Pam was outgoing and was engaged in her community as a teacher, a coach, an athlete, and a friend. She also made other plans on the weekend that she passed away. On the morning of Sunday, April 8, 1984, the Green Bay Police Department was eagerly waiting for the results of Pam's autopsy and wondered if they would rule the death a suicide, an accident, or a homicide. The carbon monoxide level in Pam's blood was 48%. For some people, this might be a fatal level, but she was alive when she entered the tub and drowning caused her death. What they did not expect was the substantial amount of trauma found on Pam's head and body. There was bruising on her right wrist, index finger, and on her right elbow. There was a hemorrhage to the structure that connected the brain to the brainstem. She had bruising that extended up from her left eye to her forehead, which was caused by blunt force trauma. There were two bruises on the top of her head, and three more in the occipital region, which were also caused by blunt force trauma. Pamela Bullock's wake took place on Tuesday, April 10, 1984. Bob had a private showing with an open casket for friends and family, then had a closed casket showing for the public. Pam's friends noticed she had bruising by her left eye that the funeral home couldn't entirely cover up with makeup. There was a lot of chatter at the wake as some participants were being interviewed by Green Bay PD. And it was news to some that Pam's death was possibly not an accident. Pam's funeral took place the next day. Her friends felt that the music that was selected for the funeral was terribly depressing and wondered why Bob did not pick out Neil Diamond, as it was one of Pamela's favorite artists. She would get pumped up before her races, listening to the musician who penned hits like Sweet Caroline and You Don't Bring Me Flowers. After the funeral, there was a lunch at Bob's house. As the guests left the lunch, Bob was missing. One of the guests thought he saw Bob getting into Linda's car. Bob was going to have more time on his hands as he wouldn't be going back to his job because they put him on paid leave. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. Thank you to Best Fiends for sponsoring this episode of Beyond Contempt True Crime. Podcast listeners, let me tell you about Best Fiends. It's an engaging puzzle game that everyone is playing. It's a laid-back game that you play on your phone. I've even played it on my iPad before. Well, mostly because I like to pretend that I don't need progressive lenses. But Best Fiends keeps adding new levels and events all the time, so the game is always popping. It's a great game to play when I need to take a break from researching podcast episodes. And you don't even need to be tethered to Wi-Fi because you can play without an internet connection, which is great for me because my internet provider sometimes lets me down. Trust me, you really don't want to miss out on this game. Join me and the millions of people who are already playing this fun puzzle game. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Hi everyone. I really need to tell you about BetterHelp Online Counseling. It's an affordable service where you can connect with one of their licensed professional therapists. You can find counselors that specialize in just about anything, including anxiety, depression, family conflicts, trauma, and LGBTQ issues. I work from home and barely leave my house, so it's great that you can communicate with your counselor from the privacy of your own home. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional in-person counseling, and financial aid is available. So many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states, and you can start talking with your counselor in less than 24 hours. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/beyondcontempt. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/beyondcontempt. Now, back to the show. John Doe hearings are specific to Wisconsin. The purpose of this hearing is to uncover if a crime was committed and to identify who committed that crime. These hearings are almost like mini trials. Witnesses are subpoenaed and must testify. After the hearing is complete, the judge decides if there's a probable cause for an arrest. The John Doe hearing concerning the death of Pamela Bullock took place on April 18, 1984. Bob seemed confident in his situation as he decided not to hire an attorney. He was concerned that the hearing would cut into his impending vacation time at his timeshare in the Bahamas. The John Doe hearing started off by revisiting the incident in August 1983 when an intruder broke into the Bullock's home and struck Pam in the head. The prosecution was confused why Bob drove his wife to the hospital instead of calling 911. Bob claimed he was too excited to think clearly. Before they left for the hospital, he also cleaned up Pam's vomit from the family room carpet. Bob said that Pam instructed him to do that before they left. The prosecution also brought up their dog Misty, the Scottish Terrier, and wondered if she barked at the intruder. Bob stated that their dog never barked at strangers who came to their home. And of course, they asked Bob about the timeline leading up to Pam's death. He stuck to the story he told Green Bay PD in his police station interview. The court dismissed Bob and allowed him to go on his vacation. Bob asked Pam's friends to pack up her stuff while he was in the Bahamas. As Pam's friends were carefully going through her belongings and denoting the things that the kids should have, they stumbled upon some interesting items. There was a box full of documents, cards, and books that were full of exchanges between Bob and Linda. Linda's will was in that box, and she named Bob as the guardian to her child if she passed away, which was a pretty significant decision, given that Pam had only been gone for a few weeks. They also found Pam's journal and read an entry she made approximately a week prior to her death, which was titled, "I Am Afraid." Pam's friends called the police and informed them about this evidence. The John Doe hearing continued, and Linda was required to testify. She said Bob called her on the evening of Pam's death and said he pulled Pam from the running van, then later that morning filled the tub so Pam could soak her legs. Bob told Linda that Pam must have slipped and drowned. Both the coroner and pathologist testified at the John Doe hearing. The most salient testimony was by pathologist Dr. Helen Young, who believed that the damage on Pam's body showed that she had been in a fight several hours prior to her death. On May 29, 1984, the outcome of the John Doe hearing resulted in an arrest warrant being signed for 36-year-old Bob Bullock. Bob was heading out on a training ride when the GBPD intercepted him and brought him down to the station. He was charged with the first-degree murder of Pam Bullock. This time around, Bob retained an attorney. He also had to call Linda so she could pick up his bike and gear. Bob's mom was no longer living and had passed away from a stroke. He still had his dad, who came up with a $100,000 bond so Bob could get out of jail. Bob's dad had to put up his house and all his other assets to come up with that money. Pam's family felt vindicated with Bob's arrest, as they felt he was extremely cold and emotionless at Pam's funeral. They were certain that their daughter had not committed suicide. This case was prominent in the Green Bay press, even though the brutal murder of Margaret Anderson was taking up much of the news media's bandwidth that year. Additionally, there was the case of Robert Storter, who murdered two people. With three high-profile murder cases all in the same year, The Green Bay PD and the district attorney's office had their hands full. The media had no shortage of headlines to print. The fact that Robert Bullock was having an affair made for many salacious love triangle headlines. When detectives interviewed the large circle of people who were friends with the Bullocks, they were purposely never told about the condition of Pam's body. After this information was put out in the public by the media, the Bullock circle of friends found the facts to be jarring. The prosecution had their hands full getting prepared for the trial, as the defense tried to file several motions to suppress their evidence. Detectives met with all three therapists who had been working with the Bullocks. Pam and Bob each had their own personal therapist, and then they had one who counseled them jointly. One therapist felt that Pam had a dependent personality disorder and felt Bob had a psychopathic personality disorder because he was a perpetual liar. This therapist felt that there was no other person in their counseling practice that lied to them more than Bob did. All three therapists felt that the incident in August 1983, when Pam was hit over the head, was never adequately explained. Their joint marriage counselor felt Bob had been involved in that incident, and this was why they recommended that Pam have him move out of the home. All three therapists believed that Pam was not suicidal. One therapist thought she had anxiety but did not have depression. Because this case was very publicized in the local media, the defense felt they could not have a fair trial if it were held in Brown County, which is the county that encompasses the city of Green Bay. The judge opted to select a jury from outside of Brown County and bust them into Green Bay for the trial. The defense filed a motion to suppress some of the evidence, including the drag marks through the grease on the garage floor and the woman's sweatsuit along with the underwear. They felt that this evidence was illegally obtained on the day GBPD were called out to the Bullock's home. The judge ruled that this evidence was allowable, as Bob allowed the police into his home and even signed a consent form to search his van. The defense filed another motion to suppress the August 1983 attack, where Pam was hit on the head, which led her to a several-day ICU stay. It was an enormous blow to the prosecution when the judge decided that this event, and anything related to it, would not be allowed in the courtroom. The judge felt it was only speculation that Bob committed this act. Pam didn't know who committed the crime and never filed a complaint against her husband, so this evidence would not be allowed in court. When this incident happened, the police wanted the Bullocks to take a polygraph test. They both eventually agreed to take the test and both passed it. Pam signed a release for the police, stating they could use the results of her test. Bob opted to not sign the release because he didn't have faith in the testing. This caused some of the Bullocks' friends to feel suspicious that Bob might have committed the crime. Bob Bullock's trial started on December 4, 1984, and lasted 8 days. Pam's mother and brother chose not to attend. Her mother was not in the best of health, and Pam's brother lived in Seattle, Washington. He worried that if he attended the trial, he might do something irrational, which would get himself in trouble. Her dad still lived in Wisconsin and attended the trial, along with Pam's stepmom. Pam's high school boyfriend was there with his wife to show support for her family. The prosecution went through some of the evidence that was found at the Bullock's residence, including finding grease on one of Pam's Saucony running shoes that was found in the master bedroom. The other shoe had a bit of dirt on it and was found in the hallway. There was grease also found on Pamela's right foot. The prosecution's point was to show the jury that Bob dragged Pam to the car, then back to the bedroom, and she hadn't walked to those places with her own free will. The wet underwear was tested, and it turned out that the stains were from dirt and not from fecal matter. The court took a break, and everyone took part in something that the Wisconsin judicial system calls a view. They took jurors to Preble High School to show them where Bob parked his car, then walked to his home to surprise Pam. The prosecution hoped that the jury would see this as a suspicious action Bob took in trying to hide his vehicle from the neighborhood. They felt Bob could have pulled his car up close to their home, since they lived on a cul-de-sac, and he could have still surprised his wife. When everyone returned to the court, the coroner testified that the wet van seat returned a positive test for urine. A pathologist spoke to Pam's 48% carbon monoxide level. A 30% level might kill a person who had poor cardio, but a person who was an athlete might not be killed until they reached a 70% level. Urine incontinence was not a side effect of carbon monoxide poisoning, so that would have not been a reason for Pam to wet the seat of the van. Pam's death was estimated to have taken place between 5 a.m. and 9 a.m. on April 7th, when she suffered from a lack of oxygen because of carbon monoxide poisoning, with drowning being the fatal event. If Pam's carbon monoxide level was 48% after her death and was tested after 11 a.m., a person could breathe off half of the carbon monoxide that was absorbed in approximately 4 to 5 hours. Reverse engineered, this would have put her at 96% several hours earlier when Bob might have pulled her out of that van. The doctor was not aware of anyone surviving 96% carbon monoxide poisoning. And if this was the case, since drowning is what killed Pam, the prosecution implied that they didn't believe the timeline of Bob's story, of him pulling her from the running van, then both of them going to bed to sleep for several hours, to her having been alive when she drowned, and her carbon monoxide level registering at 48% by the time she was tested. The defense got the prosecution's medical examiner to acknowledge that some of Pam's facial bruising could have come from her hitting her head in the tub. Prosecution's medical examiner thought that the majority of the bruising on the head occurred at least 4 hours prior to her passing and believed that this was not from a fall and had been caused by an instrument. Both of the medical examiners for the prosecution and defense agreed that the head trauma that Pam received could have rendered her unconscious. The medical expert that testified for the defense felt that the carbon monoxide could have damaged Pam's capillary walls and red blood cells, which subsequently could have made her extra sensitive to bruising from something like a light touch or a tap. This medical professional felt her wounds were not defensive. The prosecution had Pam's orthopedic surgeon testify. He was also a competitive runner and understood the sport well. This surgeon was the doctor who had treated Pam's leg and back issues from the summer of 1980 to the summer of 1983. He had prescribed she soak her legs in the whirlpool tub. Pam did not have follow-up appointments with him for the last 8 months of her life, which implied that she no longer had leg issues, and therefore they questioned Bob's story about Pam needing to soak her legs prior to a half marathon. The orthopedic surgeon explained to the jury that a competitive runner would not soak their legs prior to a race, as it would burn up the stored fuel they needed to perform. It was much more common to soak after running to help with post-race inflammation and speed up recovery. The next aspect that the prosecution tackled was they wanted to prove to the jury that Pam was not suicidal. She had been working hard to drop her weight down and improved her health and her running times. Pam was breaking personal running records and was building up to the Green Bay Marathon. Their contention was that this was not the mentality of someone who intended to end her life. Linda Vanden Langenberg's appearance generated a huge buzz, and the court was packed because everyone wanted to get a glimpse of the third person in this purported love triangle. The judge laid down firm boundaries with the media and declared that no one was to take Linda's photo because she wasn't on trial. Linda admitted her affair with Bob started in fall 1982 when they took a CPR course together. The prosecution had done some legwork, and Linda and Bob's school attendance record had shown that they took almost a dozen days off on the same dates. Linda confirmed for the prosecution that she bought Bob a YMCA membership when Pam kicked him out of the house, and she subsequently canceled it when Bob tried to reconcile his marriage. After Pam died, she reinstated Bob's gym membership. The judge called the lawyers and all the therapists into his chambers to discuss what evidence was allowable for their impending testimony. The judge clarified that there would be no talk of or reference to the August 1983 incident where Pam was attacked in her home. The therapist who provided Bob and Pam with marriage counseling worried that the potential for domestic violence in their marriage could not be discussed and felt that the attack incident was never adequately addressed. This was extremely suspicious, and they felt like Bob played a role in Pam's injuries. Bob's personal therapist told the judge that Bob had fantasized about Pam driving down an icy road where her car slid off and she died. The judge determined that this was an extension of Bob's thinking since he was having an affair and ruled that this could not be talked about in court. Back in the courtroom, the joint marriage counselor described how Bob broke the contract he signed to not see Linda. When Bob was asked if he wanted a divorce, he said no. Not because he wanted to work things out with his wife. It was to not upset his kids. When the therapist asked Bob what his ultimate fantasy of his life would be, Bob said it would be for Pam to move to Florida and for him to have his kids in home. They also implied that Pam believed that Bob had drugged her so he could spend time with Linda. When Bob found Pam dead in the bathtub, he called their therapist and asked what to do with the children. The therapist repeatedly told Bob to hang up the phone, call 911, and drop the kids off at a neighbor's house or have someone pick them up. The therapist stated that they did not instruct Bob to drive the kids to the mall like he did, then go back home and dial 911. Bob Bullock took the stand on his own behalf, and the prosecution took a very hard line with him. They established Bob talked about adding onto the house at Pam's funeral luncheon, which was not an appropriate topic of conversation given the circumstance. Bob had written many letters and communications to Linda where he perpetually said that he loved her and established that he had broken the contract he signed. The prosecution turned the heat up on Bob. They questioned if he really believed that Pam needed to soak her legs and was going to run in a race that day, given she was not responsive. They asked Bob what he would do if one of his middle school students were unconscious and not responsive. Would he immediately call someone for help? Bob said if he didn't have previous information as to the student's background, specifically their background of mental health issues, then he would call for help. Bob said his wife had known emotional problems, so he didn't immediately dial 911. The prosecution tried to impress upon the jury that Bob found his wife dead in a tub, then he carried on with plans for the day, dropping his kids off at the mall, and then continued his relationship with Linda. In the closing remarks, the prosecution wrapped up by telling the jury that Bob hit Pam on the head with an object, he placed her in a van in the garage, he started the engine of the vehicle and left her there. He made up the story about her sore legs, as if an unconscious woman would be able to run a half marathon that day, and he put her in that tub of water. Bob wanted Pam out of his life so he could have his kids and house, plus keep his relationship with his mistress, Linda Vanden Landenberg. In the defense's closing statement, they brought up facts that they thought were unequivocal. Bob cried after Pam's death, and someone who murdered their spouse would not cry. He was open and honest with all the investigators. Bob allowed them into his house. He let them search everything, including the van. He went to the station without a lawyer and answered all their questions. When Bob left his house to go pick up his car from the high school, he waved hello to his neighbor. What type of person would murder their spouse, then care enough to wave at the neighbors? Pam had mental health issues. She was worrying about her marriage all week, and she couldn't sleep because she was upset. Pamela Bullock got dressed. She went to the garage and got into the van. Bob woke up, and he heard a vehicle running. He found Pam in the van and pulled her out of it. The carbon monoxide had affected him as well, and he was not thinking clearly. The prosecution made a rebuttal to the defense's closing statement and said that a person who makes breakfast, feeds his kids, folds laundry, and drives the kids to the mall did not have significant cognitive impairment from carbon monoxide. On December 12, 1984, the jury went into deliberation and were only out for about 6 hours. The only items they asked for were the transcripts of the testimony that detailed the conversation between Bob and his therapist on the day Pam died as to what to do with the kids. Pam's father decided to not be present when the verdict was read. He had some previous health issues with his heart, and he figured he might not withstand the verdict if the outcome did not go his way. They acquitted Robert John Bullock of both first-degree and second-degree murder. There was an audible gasp in the courtroom when he was only convicted of homicide by reckless conduct. The defense team, Bob and Linda, were as equally shocked by the outcome of the verdict. They thought Bob would be vindicated of all charges. The judge allowed Bob to make a statement, and of course, he said he was not guilty and did not kill his wife. As the bailiff placed handcuffs on Bob, tears rolled down his face. Bob's brother released a statement to the news media and said that the verdict was not fair. Two weeks after the trial, Pam's stepmother told her alcoholic husband she wanted a divorce. He told her that there would be no divorce, grabbed his 20-gauge shotgun, and aimed it at his wife. She was able to take control of the shotgun and called the police. They sent him to a mental health facility for an assessment for his alcoholism. On January 19, 1985, Pam's father wrote a letter to the media that was published in many Wisconsin papers. He gave credit to the prosecution and the Green Bay PD, but the verdict upset him. His daughter was dedicated to her children and husband. She was not the dependent person that the defense tried to paint her as during the trial. William spoke with his daughter during the last few months of her life, and she told him about the affair. He tried to tell Pam that perhaps Bob committed the attack against her that summer. William felt his daughter was in denial. It upset him that this attack was not allowed to be brought up during the trial. If this information could have been used, Bob would have been convicted of murder. He said that Bob convinced his own dad, his girlfriend Linda, and his kids that he was innocent. But Bob never called him after Pam passed away, and that, to him, was an admission of guilt. William was informed by the police that his daughter had died, never heard it from Bob Bullock's mouth. On February 7, 1985, they sentenced Bob Bullock to the maximum of 10 years. The judge said that Bob played a role in Pam's death when he placed his unconscious wife next to a tub full of water, did not immediately call for medical help. The judge did not believe that Bob was impacted from the carbon monoxide. He never told the police that he had headaches, nausea, or other symptoms, and he never mentioned this during the John Doe hearing. They sent Bob to Dodge Correctional Institution in Waupun, Wisconsin. The saga of Bob and Linda did not end at his incarceration. They were engaged as of his sentencing. Pam's brother tried to get custody of her children, but Bob and Linda were married by that spring. So much to the horror of the Metzger family, Linda received custody of the children. Linda stayed at Bob's house with his kids and paid for Bob's mortgage. She would take the kids to visit their father often. Bob appealed his case in July 1985 with several arguments. Some of Bob's arguments were that the evidence presented at trial was unlawfully obtained by Green Bay PD. Their marriage counselor violated the doctor-patient privilege by giving testimony at trial. And the trial evidence was not sufficient to support his conviction. This appeal was denied. Pam's father did not live long past her death. He passed away in August 1986 in Ocala, Florida. He was brought home to Wisconsin and was buried in Wisconsin Rapids. Bob was up for parole in April 1987, and it was denied. He was transferred to Oak Hill Correctional, just outside of Madison. In fall 1987, Linda filed for divorce. Bob wasn't getting out early on parole, and she was done with paying his bills, paying his mortgage, and taking care of his kids. In September 1988, Bob transferred to Winnebago Correctional in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, so he could be closer to his kids in Green Bay. Linda was going to be moving in with her new boyfriend, and Bob's children were not invited along. The children ended up going to separate foster homes with friends from the Bullock's neighborhood. Pam's brother stopped trying to get custody of the children. Bob didn't have much longer to serve in jail, and he didn't think he could emotionally handle taking care of the kids, only to give them right back to Bob. Bob was relentless in his letter writing to the judge to get his sentence shortened. The judge did not budge. Bob tried to get parole for a third time in 1989, but was denied. They set his release date for April 1990. The therapist, who had been the Bullocks' marriage counselor, made a statement to the press and said that Bob should remain in prison and complete his sentence. The community of Green Bay, Wisconsin, had been emotionally affected by this case, and the wounds had not yet healed. They released Bob in March 1990 after serving 5 years of his 10-year sentence. He was on parole for the next 4.5 years. After Bob was released from prison, he tried to fight with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction to get his teaching license reinstated. When he was still in prison in 1988, the state of Wisconsin renewed his teaching license, which led him to believe that he could go back to teaching children once he was released from prison. The state argued that this renewal was an oversight, and his license should not be renewed based on his conviction. They felt it would be inappropriate for him to ever work with children. Bob claimed he had excellent behavior in prison, he volunteered as a tutor and career counselor, and was committed to education. Bob went back to school and graduated with his PhD in curriculum and instruction from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Pam's mother passed away in Clearwater, Florida in 1994. Bob remarried again that same year. Julie Adams was from Neenah, Wisconsin, and they were married in Crested Butte, Colorado. They had a daughter 1 year later and eventually had a son as well. Despite his felony conviction, Bob was a senior medical educator at Ohio University College of Osteopathic Medicine. He became a professor at the University of Texas Medical Branch. Bob and his wife moved to Prescott, Arizona, where he did consulting and his wife owned an art gallery. Linda Drews, and that's L-Y-N-D-A, was good friends with Pam Bullock and wrote a book called Run at Destruction that paid homage to the memory of Pam. They were friends at a key time in their 30s and were having good careers, were having families, were competitively running, and had a tight-knit circle of friends that hung out together often. Pam's last journal entry affirmed her friendship with Linda, detailed their last run together, and demonstrated that she was focused on a better future. April 1st, 1984. Five with Linda. Went good at 7 a.m. Sunny, beautiful day. Her optimism makes me feel good. I wish I had and hope I'm gaining self-assurance and satisfaction. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Beyond Contempt. Please visit beyondcontemptpodcast.com for the links to the sources and the music used in this episode. Research, writing, editing, audio production, and music scoring were performed by me. If you enjoyed this case, I recommend picking up Linda Drew's book, Run at Destruction. It was helpful in that it filled in a lot of gaps I had after trying to pull so many articles from the archives at newspapers.com. The book is worth reading because it's so much more than a true crime story. The book details their friendship at one of the most important times in life where they were balancing so many different things. Thank you to new patrons, Glenda H. and Colette P. I appreciate your support. If you like the show, please leave me a favorable review in Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much, everyone. Give me the pill that I can swallow. Yeah. Build my bricks so high, still you knock them down. Casualty, no crime on the battleground. I'm in your war zone, breaking a heart of stone. Ready the cannonball, make me a reckless soul. Feeling the fallout from brilliant smoke right now. I'm in your war zone, I'm in your war zone.
still I float on to you until the emotions I can't cut loose, and I don't want to know. I chained up the beast inside, but you're breaking him out. Let the bullet that I just can't buy come take me down. I'm in your war zone, breaking a heart of stone. Ready the cannonball, make me a reckless soul. Feeling the fallout from brilliant smoke right now.
I just wanna feel the rain, feel the rain.